All right, we'll go ahead and get started. My name is Andrew Cochran. I'm currently vice president of the consulting firm of Gage International here in Washington. I was the senior oversight counsel at the House Financial Services Committee from 2001 through 2003, and I remember dealing with these issues, more specifically in the data security area, but along with my bailiwick was the Sarbanes-Oxley Act and the accounting irregularities, those investigations, and the Patriot Act and the terrorism financing investigations. Also, I want to start by once again thanking our co-sponsors, the Financial Services Roundtable and the Consumer Bankers Association. Congress has been scrutinizing the credit card practices. Senate PSI has had a number of hearings and investigations. Several bills are in process, and then the Fed swooped down and did something nobody really expected. And so it's a good time to take a look at where we stand with that, what's really needed, whether it's going to fly, whether anything's going to pass this year or next. And to do that, we have a very distinguished panel of superstar lawyer and economists. Oliver Ireland is a partner in the financial services practice group at Morrison & Foerster. His practice focuses primarily on retail financial services, including e-commerce, compliance with Federal Reserve regulations, the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act, Patriot Act, et cetera. Prior to joining the firm, Oliver was Associate General Counsel of the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System and Associate General Counsel of the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago. He's been named one of Washington's top banking and privacy lawyers by Washingtonian Magazine and Best Lawyers of America. Adam Levitin is Associate Professor of Law at Georgetown, where he teaches courses in bankruptcy, secured lending and payment systems, and directs the Georgetown Hebrew University in Jerusalem Executive LLM Program in Business and Commercial Law. He previously practiced at Weil Gotshal and served as law clerk to the Honorable Jane Roth of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit. He has extensive writings, and we're very pleased he can be here today. And then Todd Zwicky, who I've known for quite a few years, is Professor of Law at George Mason, former Director of the Office of Policy Planning at the Federal Trade Commission, now back in academia where he can write on various topics of economic research. He was a member of the United States Department of Justice Study Group on identifying fraud, abuse, and errors in the U.S. bankruptcy system. He clerked for Judge Smith of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit, and worked as an associate at Alston & Byrd in Atlanta, Georgia. He's the author of numerous articles and several books, and has been named one of the top 50 most downloaded law authors at the Social Science Research Network. That's interesting. I run a website myself, so it's downloaded. Mr. Thomas Durkin specialized in the economics and regulation of consumer financial services in the federal government, academia, and private sectors. Before retiring in December, he was senior economist in the Division of Research and Statistics at the Federal Reserve Board, where he has also been a visiting professor. He's been an assistant and associate professor of finance at Penn State and chief economist and director of research at the American Financial Services Association. So we'll start with Oliver and go down the line. Each speaker will have about 10 minutes, and then I'll have a short comment and question, and then we'll open it to the floor for questions.
Well, I'm going to start off and sort of set the baseline, tell you where what credit card regulation looks like today and what's on the table from regulatory proposals, and then we can go into the issues a little bit more. But first of all, I think it's helpful to remember that this is what we're talking about is banking, and banking has been a popular, and finance has been a popular political issue in the United States, at least since William Jennings Bryan's Cross of Gold speech in 1896 at the Democratic Convention swept him to the Democratic nomination, and where he juxtaposed the struggle between the idle holders of idle capital and the struggling masses who produce wealth and pay taxes in the country. To the extent that my clients are banks and financial institutions, I guess they're idle holders of idle capital and not struggling masses. So, they are a highly regulated industry, and the credit card industry is a highly regulated industry. It's been that way since 1968, when the Truth in Lending Act was passed. the current Truth in Lending regulation and Federal Reserve staff commentary fits in two nice little books that are about a half an inch thick and in fine print. And the current Federal Reserve proposals on Truth in Lending, either under TILA and under UDAP, as we'll discuss later, are somewhat larger. These are the Federal Register version, so they're fine print. And this one's actually a little smaller because I had it double-sided. There's very extensive things going on in this area. In addition to the TILA regulation, of course, credit cards are provided by examined and regulated financial institutions. They are subject to private rights of action under the Truth in Lending Act. And the Federal Reserve Board, as these documents suggest, has a very broad rule-writing authority. Credit card business is not solely regulated under TILA. There are a variety of other federal statutes, including the Equal Credit Opportunity Act, the Fair Credit Reporting Act, and the various bank safety and soundness requirements that come into play. At the same time, I think the credit card industry and the credit card business, like many other financial services, has been undergoing significant change in the last decade or so. Technology and automation have enabled lenders to make finer distinctions, and competition has spawned innovation. The current regulatory structure for Truth in Lending, I think, personally, is out of date. The last time the Federal Reserve sat down and did a comprehensive revision and review of the Truth in Lending rules was 1981, over 25 years ago, and several generations ago in terms of innovation and technological developments. Currently, the regulatory structure focuses on rate, and part of this is statutory. Congress has required credit card issuers, when soliciting people for credit cards, to emphasize the annual percentage rate that's charged. And so creditors do that. And not surprisingly, we have found that one of the things that's happened in recent years is a growth in revenues from fees and charges other than that initial annual percentage rate, as people think about ways to make their products look more attractive to consumers. In light of those changes, in 2007, the Federal Reserve Board proposed a comprehensive revision to the Truth in Lending requirements for credit cards. Those proposals will require complete revision of all current disclosures, all of the current disclosure regime for advertisements, solicitations for credit cards, initial disclosures when you open the accounts, and statements are all proposed to be revised in order to update them and make them easier for consumers to understand and to make them more consistent with current market practices. Some of you may have heard the term Schumer box in the credit card world. If you're familiar with it, it's the box you see on those mailings you get that offer you pre-approved credit cards, and it lays out the annual percentage rate you could expect, and a number of other details in a tabular format. The board is going to take that basic structure, apply it to account opening, change it somewhat for solicitations, apply it to account opening disclosures, and also, to a certain extent, apply it to monthly statements. One of the criticisms of the credit card business has been that credit card issuers can change rates and fees. I think it's Professor Warren from Harvard Law School, calls it anytime, any reason, repricing of fees. I have a credit card in my wallet that says I got it in 1981. If you remember interest rates in 1981, somebody had to reprice that card along the way. I don't want 1981 interest rates. But the Fed has proposed for that before you raise rates or fees, specified rates or fees, you give people 45 days prior notice. So that essentially this would be either you raise it because they defaulted, they didn't pay you on time, or because you changed the terms of the card. They didn't pay you on time under the terms of your existing agreement. You give people 45 days notice, which would give them an opportunity if they didn't like the change and it was above their market rate to go get a card at their market rate if it was lower. There have been a number of hearings in Congress on the credit card issues, including hearings since the Fed's proposals. A lot of congressional representatives have said that they think that the proposals are inadequate. The Fed went back to the drawing board in May of this year, 2008. They came out with a set of proposed unfair and deceptive acts and practices rules with basically seven new requirements for credit cards. One of them is they looked at their 45 days prior notice and said, well, maybe that's not enough. Maybe we'll just simply ban increasing rates on credit cards. And you just won't be able to do it, except if it's the expiration of a promotional rate you gave somebody for a short period of time. It's an indexed rate, subject to a public index such as the prime rate or treasury bill rate, or somebody was at least 30 days late on their account. And otherwise, you just wouldn't be able to increase rates. So presumably, you would get a card, and it would expire at some point because they wouldn't be able to change the rate. They've proposed to specify how payments are allocated. When you make a payment and you have various rates that apply to various types of transactions, whether you've got a cash advance that might have one rate, a balance transfer that has a lower rate, and a cash purchase rate, all of which might be different, they would require how you allocate those payments instead of leaving that up to the card company, which, of course, the card issuer would be required to disclose. They've required mailings of statements 21 days before any late fees are imposed on your payment. This issue last came up in 1974 when Congress said you had to mail 14 days before you got the grace period that you may have on the credit card. Apparently, the mail system has deteriorated significantly in the last 30-some years. They've simply outlawed something called double-cycle billing. If we want to go into that, we can explain what double-cycle billing is, but they basically said you just can't do it. They've prohibited fees on certain for over limits due to certain holds, sort of micromanaging transaction details, and they have a new disclosure that they're requiring in the pre-screen solicitations. You get the mail that says you've been pre-approved for a credit card that says that if there's a range of rates in there and they don't tell you the exact rate, they have to put in a sentence that tells you what their decision on what rate to give you may be based on. Probably not completely least, is in May, the Federal Reserve and the Federal Trade Commission came out with some risk-based pricing rules, which again apply to solicitations for credit cards as well as mortgages and other products, where a specific rate is not specified, and they require lenders who give somebody less than the best rate. If you don't get absolutely the best rate that the creditor offers in the solicitation, then you have to get a notice that says, oh, by the way, you got a bad rate, and you got a bad rate because of your credit history, and welcome to our new card relationship. So it's a heavily regulated area. I think you'll probably hear those who want to go further. If you talk to industry, you would hear those who would say that the current proposals have gone too far, and that's what we're here to talk about today. Thank you.
Well, I'm here today to be the pro-regulatory heavy. I'm here to scare all of you. Boo. I'm not going to, in my opening remarks, talk about the wisdom of any of the current proposals, either the Fed's or any of the pending legislation. I think that there are varying merits depending on the particular proposal. Instead, I want to talk about the general need for regulation in the credit card industry. But I want to start with a credo. I want you to all understand that I'm not coming here as someone who has an intense ideological proclivity toward regulation. I'm someone who believes in the free market, who believes in competition, who believes in the invisible hand. But I also know that there are certain preconditions necessary for the market to work efficiently. Supply and demand are only going to achieve an equilibrium if certain conditions are met. And one of those conditions is transparent pricing. If you do not know what something costs, you will not be able to purchase an efficient amount, consume an efficient amount of it. And that's exactly the problem that's occurring in the credit card market. Credit cards are different than any other common consumer financial product in one special way. They're complex. Auto loans have maybe one or two price points. Even things like payday loans or more, if you get into the most complex stuff, some of the exotic subprime mortgage products, they have relatively fewer terms than credit cards. So let me just go through some of the price points on credit cards, just so you probably don't think of a lot of these things. Credit cards have, let's see, annual fees, merchant fees, teaser interest rates, base interest rates, default interest rates, balance transfer interest rates, cash advance interest rates, overdraft advance interest rates, late fees, over-limit fees, balance transfer fees, cash advance fees, international transaction fees, telephone payment fees, and probably a bunch that Ollie knows about that I don't. Those are the explicit price points. Then there are a whole bunch of kind of hidden price points within the way a credit card billing structure. So these are things like double cycle billing that Ollie mentioned, or it's less well known but I think equally nefarious cousin, residual interest. There are things like universal cross default and strange applications of payments to balances accruing at different rates. There are unilateral term changes, the anytime, any reason provisions. These all have the effect of being additional price points, and they're price points that you as consumers can't easily see, and you can't really tell what's going on with them. And because of this complicated price structure in the credit card industry, it's impossible for consumers to know what it actually costs to use a credit card before you use it. And as a result, you cannot be making an efficient choice about whether to use any particular credit card or whether to use a credit card at all. Let me demonstrate this to you by performing a little experiment with you. Can I have a show of hands for these questions? How many of you know the base interest rate on any of your credit cards? Okay, there are a few hands here. How many of you know the default rate? Okay, again, a few hands. How many of you know what constitutes an event of default? You know all of them? Okay. Okay, hey. And this is an unusual group here. How many of you have rewards cards? Okay, a good number of people here have rewards cards. Do you know what the limitations are on the accrual of those rewards and on the use of them? You know all the fine print? Good for you. Okay, even if you know, if you're one of the handful of people in the room who knows all this stuff, I submit that you still do not know what it costs to use your credit card, because your card is going to have, among other things, anytime, any reason term change. So the terms could have changed since we've been talking. You didn't know that. You're going to go make a purchase. And even if that didn't happen, I mean, that's not the usual situation. The price point that you know is the APR. The APR is a meaningless price point, and here's why. We don't have to get into the exotics of double cycle billing. Almost every issuer out there has what's called residual interest. So let's say in month one, you go out and you charge $500 on your credit card. You pay that $500 off on time. Month two, you go and charge you charge $400. You pay that you pay off all but $100 on time. Month three, well, what happens in month two? What's the interest being calculated on? It's more than the $400. The residual interest includes your timely payment for the period between when the billing cycle closed and the payment was received. You don't know how long it's going to take for the card for the payment to arrive, and you don't know necessarily what your balance was at the end of that billing cycle, because the billing cycle date can change when it closes. So you really don't know what the price is for using credit cards. I don't know what the price is when I use a card, and for a lot of the time that doesn't matter. You know, if you're, as long as you're not paying interest and fees, no big deal it seems. But for the consumer, a lot of us do, from time to time, fall into the interest rate trap. We forget to make a payment, or we find that, oh, the billing date got moved up by 2 days, so that the payment was late or something like that. And because of this, I think we're seeing a market that's not working efficiently. And this is not a market that's going to fix itself by itself. That would be the best thing in the world if this was a market that would self-correct. But we have a bit of a prisoner's dilemma. The pricing of credit cards as Ali was explaining, there's pressure to move away from any kind of disclosed price point, things that show up like the APR, to all sorts of contingent price points or price points that aren't really explicit, like billing practices. And that issuers have an incentive to do that. That any issuer who decided that I'm only going to have one price point, it's all going to be a base interest rate. Well, that base interest rate would be maybe, I don't know, 70, 80% APR or something. It would be astronomically high. That issuer would not be able to compete with other issuers who can advertise a 0% teaser rate and then make all their revenue in the back end fees. So this is a market that isn't likely to self-correct. The other thing I want to talk about is one of the major defenses of the card industry. And this is that the card industry is engaged in risk-based pricing, and any sort of attempt to regulate the industry will upset all the benefits of risk-based pricing. So to summarize the argument, the card industry claims that it engages in risk-based pricing, meaning that the price that you pay for a credit card is based on your individual risk profile. And the card industry says any changes that you make that are made to their sensitive algorithms will destroy the putative benefits of risk-based pricing, namely that there are lower costs of credit for credit-worthy consumers and more credit available for subprime consumers. It also means that credit-worthy consumers are not subsidizing risky consumers. If there was actually risk-based pricing, that'd be great. I don't want to subsidize anyone. I'm all for risk-based pricing. Unfortunately, that's just not what it's not an accurate description of the credit card industry. There are certain elements in credit card price structure that are risk-based. But as far as their impact on total credit card prices, only at the very margins. Most of credit card pricing has nothing to do with risk. It has to do mainly with the cost of funds for card issuers. And if you look at the handout I have here, you can see there's a thing called the card issuer's net interest margin. It's from FDIC statistics. And that's the spread that card issuers make between what they borrow at, their own cost of funds, and what they lend at. It's been pretty much static since 1989. Risk-based pricing supposedly started in the early 90s. We should be seeing a change, except that we aren't. This line is static. So there's at least, I think, a pretty good prima facie case that that the card industry does not engage in risk-based pricing. That's not to say that I can prove that conclusively or that I can show you the exact extent to it. Instead, I'd actually like to sort of put forth a challenge to the card industry, and I would suggest to Ali in particular that this is something that his clients could do to really put the kibosh on the regulatory moves. Namely, show some numbers. That this is if the card industry is engaged in risk-based pricing, it creates a powerful argument against regulation. The only ones who can actually show this definitively are the card industry themselves. They're the only ones with the numbers. For very little cost, far less, I'm guessing, than Ali's firm bills in a year or something like that, maybe $50,000, the card industry could hire an independent expert, give them the data, clean it up so no consumer identities would be revealed. It could be a study. The expert could do a statistical study showing whether the card industry engages in risk-based pricing. This has not been done. Instead, the card industry spends lots and lots of money on lobbying efforts and won't go for what could really be the sort of use the silver bullet. And that makes me wonder, is there such a silver bullet? I suspect the card industry knows very well whether it engages in risk-based pricing and the costs and benefits of this for the industry. So, for example, Ali and I testified before the House Financial Services Committee a couple months ago. And there, the deputy counsel deputy general counsel of Bank of America spoke at length about the complicated algorithms that Bank of America uses for figuring out who to issue cards to, and all their sophisticated computer modeling and testing, and the number of staffers, and how much effort they put into it. And then he was asked, "Well, what is the benefit? How much money do you make from any one of these particular pricing practices that the?" Legislation at issue proposed to curb. No idea. Well, either, you know, it's either just not believable that the card industry spends all this money on these very fancy billing practices and consumer testing and doesn't know the benefit, or these benefits are so small that they really just don't matter, and that they should not be, that they don't affect pricing, and the risk-based pricing argument is really a smokescreen. So with that, I think let me just say a word about kind of the maybe a moral narrative that goes on, and this matches on to the subprime market. Do I have a minute? We in the subprime market, when discussing subprime issues, we kind of see two competing narratives. One is a narrative of abusive lenders, and the other is a narrative of irresponsible borrowers. And I would submit that these are not in any way inconsistent narratives. I mean, this is like addicts and pushers, that you can't have one without the other. Let me just say, the credit card market is, if anything, we hear about liar loans in the housing market, but really every credit card account is essentially a liar loan. The level of income verification in the card industry is pretty much nil. So, I mean, of course, yes, it's not secured lending, but all the more so you'd think you'd want to have some sort of verification. And when I'd like us to move away from thinking that this is about beating up on the banks in a cross of gold speech versus protecting the poor innocent consumers. Instead, if we see that there's a problem in this market, that we have both problems on the lender side and on the consumer side, but it's really the same problem, that there's lending being done on terms that people can't pay back, and people are willing to borrow on those terms. What's the most efficient way to solve it? We could regulate the lenders, or we could regulate the consumers. Frankly, it's much easier to regulate the lenders because there are just fewer of them, and they are already within the ambit of sort of the federal regulatory system. Trying to fix things on the consumer end through, let's say, bankruptcy reform is much harder to do. We have a much better and more efficient tool for regulation going on the federal side, and I'd be happy to talk about any of the specific proposals and questions in our conversation.
I can never talk sitting down. I get too excited, so I'm going to stand up. And first, I also want to note, Andy, that in addition, we have a superstar moderator for this panel, as well as economists and lawyers. Credit cards are one of the most powerful pro-consumer financial innovations, I think, really since the dawn of money itself, when you think about what credit cards have done to revolutionize consumer behavior and in society. It's transformed the way we shop, travel, and live. Just think, we couldn't have the e-commerce revolution without widespread access and ownership of credit cards. And that has brought a lot of other things with it, such as expanded consumer choice and competition. So not only have we had – so we've had increased competition in retail markets that have helped consumers as a result of the development of credit cards. It's revolutionized travel. My students don't even know what a traveler's check is or who Carl Malden was, basically because, you know, you can take a credit card with you anywhere you go in the world. You can buy a car with a credit card. You can't even rent a car without a credit card. It's revolutionized the way we live. To think we don't have to deal with the inconvenience of writing checks. We don't have to deal with the inconvenience of going to the ATM machine. And empirical evidence shows, for instance, that credit card use is higher in neighborhoods where crime is more widespread. It's much safer than carrying cash around with you. Small businesses obviously have benefited from widespread access to credit cards, and consumers have benefited from the dispute resolution sorts of services that they get. It's an incredible a product, and so I think when we're thinking about regulating credit cards, I think we really need to keep in mind we tend to take for granted, I think, the benefits of credit cards, but I think we need to keep that in mind. Now the real question, as Adam said, is a cost benefit analysis and really a question of complexity. Now credit cards used to be pretty simple, right? I think perhaps before my time, but credit cards were pretty simple products, right? A $40 annual fee and an 18% interest rate for everybody, right? And a lot fewer benefits than we have today. We could go back, I guess, to that credit card system of high fixed interest rates, high annual fees, and an absence of benefits like frequent flyer miles, all car rental insurance, and all the other things we get for it. And so then the real question is the increased complexity we see today worth it, right? Is the benefits of increased complexity worth it, or should we go back to the old system of $40 annual fees and 18% interest rates? Now, I think that the widespread use of credit cards and how quickly it's spread shows that consumers obviously are gaining some benefit from it. But three basic concerns have been expressed. First is a fear of rising consumer indebtedness caused by access to credit cards. Second, a concern about unjustifiably high interest rates on credit cards. And third, a concern about so-called hidden fees, such as late fees and overdraft fees. Now, so I've looked at the data and the economic literature on this. My sense is that although the conventional wisdom expresses much concern about these, I'm not sure that it actually holds up. So first, let's talk about the widespread concern that credit cards have generated widespread consumer over-indebtedness. And I put on your tables some handouts. And if you want to look at the first one, this is the debt service ratio, which comes from the Federal Reserve. And the debt service ratio is the amount of household income spent every month paying your debts. So it's your monthly payment on your car loan, your monthly payment on your student loan, your monthly payment on your credit card is calculated. I think it's 2.5% of your outstanding balance. Monthly payments on your mortgage. So the first page, what we see here is first from 1980 when the Federal Reserve started keeping this information to about 2000, the top line is the total debt service ratio. And what we see is it fluctuates within a relatively narrow band. For instance, it was lower in 1995 than it was in 1986, for instance. Why? Primarily because of drops in interest rates, in part caused by changes in the cost of funds, but also increased competition in the credit card market, among other things. And then what we see at the tail end is the upward tick of the past few years, which, as it turns out, if you look at the picture, is actually driven by mortgage debt service ratio and the subprime issues we were talking about this morning. So if you turn over to the next page, what you see is the debt service ratio for non-revolving plus revolving consumer debt. This is credit cards, student loans, everything but your mortgage, right? And what we see is that the number in 2007 is the same as it was in 1980. It fluctuates within a fairly narrow band. And you say to yourself, how can that be? We all know that people are charging their credit cards to the hilt, right? And we see press releases all the time about people charging their credit cards to the hilt. What we don't see, though, are the press releases that say personal finance company loans drop to all-time low, right? Retail installment credit at Sears drops to all-time low, right? What has happened? Well, we know what has happened. Our common experience tells us what happened if we just look at it, which is that the growth in credit card debt has been a substitution for other forms of debt. The growth in credit card debt has been a substitution for other forms of consumer credit. Now, our common experience tells us that's a huge amount of what's going on. The question is it 100%, 90%, 80%, or whatever? Well, if you look at the next chart, what you see is if you look at the revolving and the non-revolving debt, what you see is almost mirror images of each other, right? You see installment debt going down, credit card debt going up. And what you see is that's how you get to the result that the debt service ratio for consumer debt remains the same throughout this entire period. Personal, if you needed $5,000 20 years ago or $2,000 to fix your car, you'd go to a personal finance company, borrow $2,000, repay it over 24 months at, $100, say, a month. If you wanted to buy a refrigerator or a bedroom set, you'd go to the local store, you'd take out a line of credit, and you'd repay it as installment debt over 24 or 36 months, right? That doesn't exist anymore. If you buy a refrigerator today, you don't open a line of credit at the local store, right? You put it on your credit card. If you need a car repair, you don't go to the personal finance company and sit down and fill out the little paperwork, right? You put it on your credit card and you revolve it if you need to, and you repay it when you can or you want to. And so what we know is that credit cards have basically been a replacement. The next chart I have, I think, further illustrates the point, which is this is the substitution effect among bankruptcy filers taken from Warren and Westbrook's work. And what you see there is, again, almost the exact same mirror image, which is a rise in credit card debt that matches a decline. The overall total debt of bankruptcy filers remains the same, and what you see is a rise in unsecured credit card. What you see is a rise in credit card debt. Again, even among bankruptcy filers, the evidence seems to suggest that credit card debt is substituting for other forms of debt. Same sort of thing if you look at the next couple charts, which you can go to in the questions if we have time. The same sort of things are going on for lower income consumers. And if you talk in the survey research that people like Greg Gelihausen have done, shows that basically the growth of credit cards among low income consumers is also a result of the substitution effect. They've got a fairly clear pecking order, which is if you have a credit card, you use the credit card. If you've maxed out your credit card or can't get one, you go to a payday lender. If you get turned down for the payday lender, you go to the pawn shop. And it turns out most payday lenders are located in pawn shops, so that if you get turned down for a payday loan, then you go to the next counter over and basically have to take out a pawn shop loan as a backup. So again, it's been a dramatic increase in a consumer choice for lower income people, but again, no evidence if you look at this that it's increased total indebted debt service ratio for low income consumers. So what's going on? Well, I think that are people being fooled, or are they acting rationally? Well, I mean, it seems pretty clear to me that credit cards are a pretty darn good product. I think it would stink that if I had to borrow $2,000, I'd have to go to a personal finance company. And certainly it is better than pawn shops and retail store credit and that sort of thing. Now what's gone on with pricing in credit cards? Well, first what we have here is I did a little chart that compares credit cards to personal finance loans. And all this is the interest rate. This doesn't take into account the costs that are associated with a personal finance loan, which is usually you have an underwriting cost and fixed fees and that sort of thing. But what you see is that over time, those two rates have collapsed. Have come together. And what have we seen? We've seen three waves of pricing, really, in the credit card industry. The first was the old credit cards, the $40 annual fee, and the high fixed interest rates. Basically, what happened was the deregulation of the credit card market unleashed competition. The first thing that happened was in the early 90s is we got rid of annual fees. Why is that? Well, it turns out annual fees were simply a mechanism to evade usury regulations, which is that when interest rates are capped, basically what would happen is issuers just attached an annual fee to make up for the money they were losing on the usury regulations. Of course, that also had the effect of forcing transactional users to subsidize revolvers who are getting a lower interest rate. One reason why credit cards had trouble making headway in the 70s and into the 80s was because of usury regulations. Department stores controlled the credit card market, and they had an even better scheme, which is that they could just bury their credit losses in the price of the goods they sold. So states that had, for instance, stricter usury regulations, it costs more for you to buy a refrigerator, 5 to 8% more to buy a refrigerator in a state that had strict usury regulations. They would just bury the price of the credit in the price of the goods. Am I almost out of time? All right. I'll just close with the two final waves. The second wave then was we got rid of annual fees, and eventually we went to flexible interest rates. Now what we have today is a combination of no annual fees, flexible interest rates, and a greater use of behavior-based fees that are linked to people's actual behavior and whether they demonstrate whether or not they are risky. A paper by Masood Saunders and Skolnick finds that, in fact, penalty fees are assessed on riskier borrows. Ashcraft, Dick, and Morgan also have a paper where they find that the spread on interest rates increases when charge-offs rise. So I think that by all indication, we've seen a process of beneficial consumer, pro-consumer competition and increasing sophistication in prices.
Mr. Durkin. Thank you. It's certainly my pleasure to be here with you today. Probably was clear to you in the biographical introduction. I'm not a lawyer. That may be an advantage in the real world, maybe not in this group, but I certainly some of my best friends are lawyers, and I always like being with lawyers. You know, on the way over here today, though, I was thinking that I haven't made all that many presentations since I left the Federal Reserve. And at the Federal Reserve, there's always this tradition that you have to say in any presentation that these are your own views and not the views of the Federal Reserve or anybody else. I usually add on this or neighboring planets. I was thinking that, you know, actually nothing is different. What I'm going to say today, even though I don't work for the Federal Reserve anymore, is strictly my views. And there is an advantage, though, of getting old, I guess, and retiring, and that is you don't have to be politically correct anymore. And so I really can now say anything I want. But rather than talk about that or talk about what's going on in the credit card markets, the regulations, the changes in the regulations and stuff, and I've been even up to my eyeballs more in that than I think probably people are alleged to be in debt. But what I'd rather talk about is a little bit of factual information about credit cards, about the credit card markets and what's going on and so forth, because I think there's sometimes a lot of misinformation out there. So I did provide a handout for you. It really only has a few pages, and I would just like to talk a little bit about each one of them in the form just simply of looking at a few facts. Credit cards, as has been widely pointed out, are, of course, a profitable banking product. And if you look at the first chart, I think you can see that. I put two lines on that chart. One is the Federal Reserve series of credit card profitability. The other one's the FDIC. I don't think they tell any different story. They're not exactly the same. They're almost exactly the same, though. And so I just did it in case somebody's familiar with one and not with the other. I wanted to have both of them. I think that people may think that credit cards are a particularly profitable product, and actually the return on assets at credit card banks, and this is the profitability of credit card banks, not of credit cards per se, because there are some banks that are not credit card banks that issue credit cards nonetheless. But credit cards as a product of credit card banks are really different than other banking products. For one, you have a portfolio here that's almost completely unsecured. There's very little secured credit in a credit card bank. It's also an undiversified product, and that, of course, as you know from your days in taking undergraduate finance, any of you did, is not a good way, a recommended way of reducing the risk in the portfolio. It's also highly cyclical and volatile. As you can see, there's a fair amount of fluctuation in this. And credit cards are also very capital intensive. There's a lot of specialized equipment. You know, you can't take a call center and turn it into a bowling alley if something goes wrong. I mean, there's a lot of communications equipment. There's specialized personnel. There's a lot of specialization and so forth. Again, the sort of thing that leads to the necessity of it being a reasonably profitable activity before anybody will be willing to invest in that activity. Now another one has come about, and that is the political risk. It's political risk for credit cards has always been there in the background looming. Now I think we're really seeing it. Everybody says that something is going to happen on Capitol Hill. Something is going to happen in the Federal Reserve to change the revenue structure of the industry, and certainly that adds to the risk and the necessity of a profitable being a profitable activity. Now, if you flip to the next chart, the next chart shows the basic sources of revenues for the credit card industry, and I think that this chart is sort of interesting. I keep this up every year as new figures become available and so forth. And the trend over recent decades, as you can see, I think, is toward what I would characterize as behavioral pricing in the industry. There's something for everybody. There's interest for revolvers, for example. And, of course, the fact that there's interest for revolvers, that they can benefit then when rates fall, also, and they can make a choice when rates rise again, that they find that rates rising, then they can make a choice whether or not they want to use their credit card some more. There's also, you can see the second line there down, that there's interchange fees. And we agreed as a panel that we wouldn't talk about interchange, particularly the difficulties with antitrust questions and so forth and so on. It's beyond the scope of this panel. But I couldn't very well leave it out because it is an important revenue source, as you can see. That has been rising over the past couple of decades from about 10% of revenue to about 20% of revenue in recent years. The third line here, though, is the fees. And I think there, if anything, that there's very little story there. You see it was 10% in 1990. I do apologize that I didn't put the numbers of the years on the tick marks, but you can tell this is from the legend of the charts, 1990 to 2007. You can count up if you really want to. But in 1990, it was about 10%, the sum of them. And in the year 2007, it was also about 10%. Now, I provided two charts on the sources of revenues because I didn't want to busy up the first one while you were focusing on those fees. The second chart is just a little bit busier than the second one because I broke down the fees then into the two kinds of fees, namely the annual fees and the so-called penalty fees. And you see at the beginning of this period, the annual fees were a little bit larger in magnitude than the penalty fees. That crossed in 1993, I believe it was, and you can see that the penalty fees have been above the annual fees as a proportion of revenue since that time. It's also true, though, that, you know, I would say that they haven't changed a great deal, and it depends on what point you want to make. In 1990, the penalty fees were a little bit less than 5%. In 2007, they're a little bit more than 5%. Or, in other words, they about doubled. You see, if you double a very small number, you still have a small number. And so, you know, you can make anything out of this you want. It's a 100% increase. It was a small number. It's a bigger small number. Okay? That is what we're really talking about here that has seemed to cause so much heartache and angst within the four walls of the Washington Beltway. Those of you who are eagle-eyed will notice, particularly in the earlier chart, that in 2007 it only adds to about 95%. That's, again, just to avoid busying up the chart. There's a couple of more things that are small numbers that I left out, in particular the cash advance fees, which now is about 5% of revenues for the credit card industry. So that's where the missing 5% is. The penalty fees, of course, are fees that are tied to abusers, regardless of whose fault it is. Those are the people who don't pay, and they pay penalty fees or over-limit fees. I think probably most people in the room have never paid an over-the-limit fee. It's possible to survive in this world without doing so, and the credit card industry hasn't been able to fool some of us into doing that. Looking at the next chart, that simply looks at the trends in expenses, and you can see there the decline in cost of funds over time that's mirrored roughly by an increase in expenses due to the riskiness of the portfolio, the losses, and so forth. Now, again, eagle-eye mathematicians will conclude that this chart has to sum to one, and so if one goes up, the other one has to go down, and vice versa, and so forth and so on. But I think there's more to the story than that. There's a reason why they're changing, and that is simply while the cost of funds fell over these years, that the industry was able to become a little bit more competitive on the riskier end of the spectrum, and that, of course, leads to a little bit higher fees and the doubling of that small number over time and other things that have happened in the area of pricing. Now, if I had more time, and I think I'm probably running out of time already, I think you may be able to tell I could talk about this stuff for a long time. I've always said, you know, when I and my friends get together and talk about these things, you know, if a bomb goes off in the room, it will wipe out the people who are really interested in this stuff all at once. But I really could keep going. And in particular, I would like to talk about the card holding and the trends in that. You see that everything I do tends to have a historical discussion to it. I'm just interested in those things, not so much where things are, but how things have changed is always of interest to me. But I also included a couple of tables there. One of them is just a very simple table that is in a Federal Reserve Bulletin article that I wrote, along with a lot of other tables. If you flip to the next handout, and that is consumer satisfaction over a long period of time with different forms of credit. And the question was just simply how satisfied were you with the credit experience? This was after asking a lot of other questions of the consumer about the credit experience. And you see consistently, it doesn't make any difference what time period or what type of credit, about 90% or more of consumers seem satisfied with their credit experience. More important, I think, is the proportion that seems very dissatisfied. That fluctuates at a very low level depending on the year and the type of credit. In particular, I think the most interesting is the credit card in year 2001. I'd love to update the table. It's expensive to do that, and so I haven't done that. I suspect it would not show anything much different. Finally, the last table that I would draw to your attention is one asking about whether or not credit cards make their managing their finances easier or more difficult. And you see that most people say that it makes it easier. You find that there's some people that say that it's either no different or more difficult. So everything isn't perfect with credit cards, obviously. But I think that that response is as much that credit makes my life more difficult than it is a particular form of credit, as Todd pointed out. One is simply just a substitute for the other. But to me, the more interesting and the reason for asking this question is the second column there, and that is just simply trying to differentiate people's views of their own experience with their views of others. Everybody knows that the other guy doesn't know who to vote for, right? We know who to vote for, though, because we're smarter. Well, the same thing carries over into other forms of analysis of people. You see that 10% of the people say it is more credit cards make my life more difficult, but 40% say that it makes other people's life more difficult because they know those other people aren't as smart as they are. Well, you know, there's a lot of that goes on inside the Washington Beltway, too, and I'm sorry, but I mentioned at the outset that I don't have to be politically correct anymore. Finally, truth in lending. I think I have run out of time. I'll just say a couple of words about Truth in Lending. I think the Truth in Lending Act was a very good act. It has severe problems to it, I think. But remember, there's two things about Truth in Lending that we have to keep in mind. And generally speaking, only one of those is kept in mind. The first is the Truth in Lending is to provide information on how the marketplace works. And when it provides information, even if the information is imperfect or not perfectly understood, it still improves the competitive situation in the market, and people benefit from a more competitive marketplace even if they don't understand anything themselves. So the market is more competitive and the prices more approximate the costs and so forth. You benefit even if you don't know anything. The second benefit of Truth in Lending is the individual behavior, the benefit for an individual in understanding his own condition and situation. That, as I mentioned, may or may not be important to an individual who benefits, but I think that probably most people would be better off if they knew more. But Truth in Lending can't solve that problem. It can't teach everybody everything. It's a regulation to improve the condition of the market and people's understanding. If people don't understand everything, it's not an educational vehicle. It can't solve the difficulty of illiteracy, and somebody once called it innumeracy, whatever that means. In my case, then, I would say that Truth in Lending basically has worked. It hasn't worked perfectly, but one of the things it can't do is substitute for a perfect educational system or perfect knowledge. And so I think the standard for Truth in Lending should be more than finding an individual anecdote of somebody who doesn't understand.
Okay. Thanks very much. I'm going to keep my comment very short. Oliver referred to the mail as going bad. Actually, someone in my family, he had a credit card payment to Cap One, four figures. It got lost in the mail for 15 days. And as a result, his interest rate went from 9 to 27%. No joke. One payment. And I told that to Elise Bean, sent a PSI. She said, oh, bring him in. We want to talk. I said, he doesn't want to talk. But that was, I thought that was intriguing. So, by the way, my relative now uses internet payments all the time. He just pays it off on the internet.
Let me just add a mail anecdote, actually. It's not a personal anecdote, but a few years ago, Providian Bank, now a subsidiary of Washington Mutual, got hit with a whopper of a penalty from the Office of Comptroller of the Currency. This is, I think, one of maybe the six bank civil monetary penalties that the OCC has laid down since the year 2000. And what Providian was doing was it was intentionally misbarcoding the envelopes, the return envelopes for consumers' checks. So the mail, even if the U.S. Postal Service doesn't mess up, the mail still may not work.
That's interesting. I might have something else to point out, but I want to open it up to questions from the floor, please. And please approach the microphone and identify yourself.
John Choate. Professor Zwicky, on your substitution among bankruptcy filers, the left column is dollars, and I noticed that the credit card debt was $1,000 in 1981, $10,000 in 1997. So am I to assume that these are in 1981, 1991, 1997 dollars?
No, these are in constant dollars.
Constant dollars, okay.
Other questions?
Hi, I'm Marcus Kelly with Federal Financial Analytics. I know the panel said that they think that interchange fees is beyond the scope. It's kind of sad about that, considering House Judiciary has had one hearing on this so far, and Chairman Conyers has threatened another in bringing the banks in for the second hearing. I really wanted to get the panel's opinion, if they had any, on where some of these bills might go, especially the Hinchey bill capping interest rates on cars, and also what Congress might do in terms of interchange fees.
Predictions, Oliver.
I think a federal interest rate cap, I would be very surprised if that passed. We've had interest rates vary, and sooner or later those caps become constraining. I'm old enough to remember 1981. Some of the rest of you are. It's almost any cap you set where you think you're doing anything is going to be a problem sooner or later. Interchange, as I see it, is a battle basically between big banks and big merchants. The bill that has been offered in Judiciary seems to me to be probably one of the worst possible solutions to that issue that I can imagine. I suppose that if somebody pressed me, I could imagine worse ones. But from a legislative standpoint, it doesn't seem to me that that's going to solve anything if there is a problem. And I'm not sure there is.
Professor Levitt.
Well, I'll take the issues in the same order Ali did. I think it's very unlikely that a flat interest rate cap like the Hinchey bill will pass. I think it's more likely that we would see something. I think there are a couple bills out there that have a sort of a floating cap, that is, that penalty rates would be limited to, I think the two bills that proposed it, as being 7% above the base rate, whatever the base rate might be. The chance of that passing, though, I'd still put, you know, candy capping legislation is extremely difficult. Legislation in general is not likely to pass, but I'd put those as some of the less likely credit card regulatory provisions to pass. Provisions capping other types of fees more likely. So things like just limiting the number of over-limit fees in a cycle, I would think it would be more likely to pass. On interchange, wow, I'd love to have just a whole panel on that. I would disagree with Ali's characterization that this is big banks versus big merchants. It's big banks versus lots and lots of merchants, not just big ones. Also, the small ones are very much in the game on this. The gas station owner, franchise owners, and the convenience store owners, as well as things like the large grocery store chains. The dynamics of interchange are very complicated, and in the U.S., we have kind of a regulatory void. Elsewhere, the central bank has stepped in to deal with interchange issues. So in Australia, the Reserve Bank of Australia passed a number of regulations on somewhat capping the interchange rate and allowing merchants to pass on interchange fees to consumers. The Federal Reserve claims that it does not have the authority to do so. Strangely enough, they're studying the issue quite closely. I don't suppose they study baseball, even though they don't have the authority to regulate it. But because of that void, we're either going to see a resolution in the courts or in Congress. And those two tracks are both proceeding apace. The chance that the Conyers bill is going to pass is low. Is it the best solution? I can think of better ones, but is it the worst solution? I can think of much worse. And it's definitely, I think, interchange is a problem that really needs to be addressed, in that we do not have open competition for interchange rates because merchants are not able to pass on fees.
I'll say on interchange, the bizarreness of the proposal that's been floated, I think, is about the best evidence one could see that Congress fundamentally has no idea. They are utterly clueless as to what interchange is or what they're doing on it. I mean, anybody who had any understanding of anything wouldn't come up with something as bizarre as that, right? So I think that's just sort of a cautionary tale that of sort of what the baseline is for that. And Once you add in things like the understanding of two-sided markets on this, once you recognize that American Express and Discover have implicit interchange fees in what they're doing, they just don't call it interchange fees because they're vertically integrated. There's just so many complexities in this issue. Now, does that mean that Congress will acknowledge that they don't have any clue what they're doing? I don't know, but their starting point does not provide confidence that they're on the right track. With respect to regulating various terms such as interest rates and that sort of thing, we know that usury regulations, for instance, in substantive regulation have three effects. Well, one intended effect, which is they limit whatever it does, and three unintended effects. First, what it does is it causes term substitution, which is, as we said, if you cap interest rates, what you're going to get are annual fees or something like that. Secondly, it causes product substitution, which is it causes, as I've suggested, it causes substitution, say, from credit cards to retail store credit if the retail store can bury credit losses or implicit interest rate in the price of goods or something like that. And third, it may end up causing rationing in the end, which – surprising, you know, which is there's enough flexibility to be able to reprice terms and that sort of thing that's generally not a problem. Now, that, for reasons I explained in Sorry Work, can have very serious negative consequences for competition once you start encouraging people to reprice terms from. And a lot of the way in which credit has been regulated is completely backward, the way I think of it, which is that they regulate the most prominent terms like interest rates and thereby cause incentives to substitute to less prominent terms, and there what you end up doing is creating exactly the heterogeneity that we don't want to see. Now, as a general rule, what about substantive regulation? Well, what we know is that when it comes to disclosure and understanding, Adam gave the good example that nobody here knows their interest rate, nobody here knows their default terms, that sort of thing. I don't know my interest, I don't know my default terms, so what, right? The reason is it doesn't matter. I mean, I don't know a lot of things, right? I don't know how my computer works. I don't know how my car works because it doesn't matter, right? So why would I care about things that that don't matter to me? When you look at the literature, what you see is the things that matter for people, they actually pay attention to. So, for instance, those who revolve debt, and there's very few here who revolve debt, those who revolve debt know what their interest rate is. They shop on their interest rate and they switch cards to get better interest rates. People, research that Tom has done suggests that people in general know about penalty fees and that sort of thing, and they're very certain that if they needed the information that they can get it. So that people in fact shop on the margins that matter to them, and they have a general and they have awareness of those terms. One final point that kind of pulls the two together is the Massoud article that I referred to does in fact find out that there is a trade-off between interest rates and penalty fees. So that an increase in penalty fees leads to a decrease in interest rates, and they quantify exactly what the trade-off there is in their empirical results.
Mr. Durth. One of the advantages of speaking less is I guess I can, get the benefit of
whatever everybody else said. We're going to have a second round.
Oh, but I was just going to say that doesn't mean that I learned anything about interchange along the way because I don't really know very much about it. But getting back to the original question, whether or not I can help in forecasting the likelihood of that bill passing, I have no clue. I certainly hear from people that the likelihood of any bill passing this year is low. The likelihood of any bill with complexities in it is even lower. And so I would guess that the likelihood of that bill with the complexities concerning interchange is quite low. But I did hear from a lobbyist recently who told me that if we will know by the end of June, in his view, that by that time that these things will be determined. And he called it some term for the, like the death march or something. Well, it was a much better term than that for the month of May and June, what was going to be true in Washington. But let me just mention, though, getting back to a different thing, they the recent 18F UDAP proposal from the Federal Reserve. You know, Ollie mentioned before interest rates in 1981, and a couple of us around the room here have gray enough hair to remember 1981 or particular 1980. And I think one of the things that happened in 1980 was particularly interesting, and people don't remember this, that bank cards didn't have fees, annual fees on them before 1980. There was competition in the marketplace, and Visa, it wasn't called Visa then, it was called the Bank America Card, and MasterCard, which was called MasterCharge in those days, that they didn't have annual fees. It was too competitive. And what happened was that the government came along in the spring of 1980 with credit card controls. Some of you may remember that. But what happened was that everybody in the marketplace wanted to charge more, but the competition didn't let them do that. In a very short period of time, in March and April of 1980, nobody wanted additional market share. Now, if you want to hear about the saga of 1980, I can tell you about it, but I don't really want to get into it. The point is, though, that nobody wanted additional market share in the spring of 1980, and so they raised prices like that. Annual fees got put onto the bank cards like that. Well, there's a couple of provisions. I call that Jimmy Carterizing, because it was a political maneuver at the time to help Mr. Carter get himself reelected. I call it Jimmy Carterizing the credit card market at the time. What they did was they made competition unattractive for a very short period of time, and everybody raised prices. It took a very long time then to compete that back away. It finally did get done, and annual fees disappeared with the AT&T Universal Card. There's a couple of Jimmy Carterizing provisions in the most recent bill. One of them is that, you know, it's my impression that people don't want to compete on the basis of teaser rates anymore. It's expensive, that, you know, it's sort of run its course. What they did is they're proposing to make teaser rates unattractive. Everybody's going to raise prices like that. You watch. The other one is the provision in there that suggests that you cannot raise the rate on past balances, except in a couple of circumstances. And one of them is that you have a genuine variable rate. Fixed rates are gone. You wait. And I'll come here in 10 years from now after this has worked its way through the system and everybody has had to change everything. There's been immense costs and so forth and so on. And I'll show you those same charts and everything will be the same, except that we won't have competition on some of those margins, and I think that's unfortunate. What happened was that the credit card proposal, the controls proposal, sank beneath the waves after 3 months in 1980, with one exception, and that was the annual fees, and it took them 10 to 15 years to get rid of them.
Okay, we're going to go second round, so Oliver, go ahead.
I'd like to revisit and change on one thing. And
the I word.
I've been in this business long enough so that I'm going through a lot of things for the second or third time, the second mortgage crisis. The big wave of credit card legislation or this kind of issue, billing practices and so on, was 1974, and done by Senator Proxmire. And the interchange issue was a big debate in 1974 with Senator Proxmire, and people came in and said, we have to pay this interchange. It wasn't called interchange, it was merchant discount. And so they picked up charge cards as well as interchange between the card associations. So they picked up, I guess Discover didn't exist, they picked up Amex and what was it then, Diners Club and a few others. And they very carefully, Congress considered it, thought about it, and they passed a bill, and they said and the bill's still there. It's been modified a little bit since then, but it says anybody who wants to offer a discount for payment in cash, and there are some technical reasons for that as well as some competitive reasons for that, instead of somebody who uses credit cards, can do that. So any merchant out there who says, I want to offer you a lower cash price if you give me cash instead of a credit card, or you give me a check instead of a credit card, is perfectly free to do that. And that's been in federal legislation since early, mid-1970s.
Well, let me first start by, I want to respond to a couple things Todd said first, and then I want to come back to the cash discounting. Todd said it doesn't really matter if he doesn't know the cost of credit. Well, imagine if you were going to buy a computer. You don't need to know how the computer works on the inside, but you do need to, you probably want to know what the computer costs. When you use a credit card product, if you're you want to know what not even if you're going you're planning on only being a transactor, you still might want to know what would happen if you revolved, what would happen if you made a late payment, because if you want that will change how careful you are as whether to turn the payment in on time. And then about almost 2/3 of Americans have revolved a balance in the last 6 months. If you pull that back over the last 2 years, it's probably a much larger number. That most of us in this room probably are not revolvers, or at least regular revolvers, but you only have to fall into the cycle one or two times for you to be paying a fair amount of money. So I'm not sure that it's as irrelevant as Todd would like to cast it, that we don't know, that no one really knows the price. And revolvers really do not have a great command on the details of their costs. They have a little better idea than transactors, but they don't know enough to actually be able to gauge the price accurately. Also, Todd cited a couple times an article by Nadia Massoud and some co-authors. Todd, the last point you cited her for was correct. The first point, though, that her study shows risk-based pricing, it affirmatively does not, and I have corresponded with Nadia about this. She her sample does not have individual level data, so it cannot test for that. It can only test about bank-level risk profile and bank pricing. So it's overall riskiness, not individual consumer riskiness. Also, it's worth saying a word about, I don't know how many of you are lawyers here, but if you recall, some basic contract law principles are really kind of don't hold up in the credit card market. There's something called the pre-existing duty rule. Once you strike a bargain, those are the terms of it. They don't get changed. If I go and borrow money, make a deal with you to borrow money at 10%, you can't then go and change that to 20%. Down the road, but that's very much what happens with credit cards. You have retroactive pricing. So I went and decided it was efficient for me to borrow money on a credit card at 10% to buy a computer. Well, it turns out I wasn't borrowing at 20%. Why? Why did I get repriced? Well, it might have been something like I was late paying my cable bill, or maybe I was justified in withholding payment on my cable bill. I had a bona fide dispute with the cable company, and I was exercising my rights, but somehow that showed up in my credit report, and then the card issuer then said, Levitin is risky, so we're going to raise his rates, even though he's always paid his bills to us on time. That may be an extreme example, but that's what's going on with risk-based repricing, or at least what the card industry calls risk-based repricing. Cash discounts. Yeah, this is a fascinating little thing. Merchants are allowed to offer a discount for cash by federal law. However, they're not allowed to surcharge for credit according to credit card network rules. Well, this is kind of a glass half full and a glass half empty. I could price a computer at $1,000 for cash and then have a 2% credit surcharge, or I could price it at what would that be, $1,020 for credit and have a cash discount of some amount to get it down to $1,000. They're the same thing mathematically. Economically, though, cash discount and a credit surcharge are very different. Consumers react much more strongly to a surcharge, which they perceive as being sort of a penalty, versus a discount, which is some sort of serendipitous fine for them. And there's very strong consumer testing on this, even with credit cards. But the ability to offer cash discount is ultimately irrelevant because merchants don't want cash. I mean, Todd laid out the case really nicely that credit cards are these great products. They really are. I mean, for whatever problems they have, they're fantastic products. They have lots of benefits over most other payment systems with the possible, we can kind of carve out debit cards, which Todd didn't get into. The credit cards are these great products. Merchants like credit cards. They like taking credit cards, but merchants don't want to take rewards cards. Because when you get rewards, who's paying for that? It's the merchant. That's what interchange, if you look at the accounting statements of monoline card issuers like Capital One or the old MBNA statements, on their financials, they actually have rewards as a reduction in interchange income. That's the way they schedule it. So rewards programs are being funded explicitly by interchange. merchants are paying. So if I use a rewards card and Todd does not, the merchant is paying money to me, even though I'm not there's no benefit to the merchant. I'm not going to go and make a larger purchase because I can get a few frequent flyer miles. Maybe, just maybe, at a few stores I would do that, but a lot of merchants, you have to get outside the model of retail. You can pay college tuition with credit cards. You're not going to buy more tuition or go to a fancier college because you can pay with a credit card. Or insurance. You're not going to buy more insurance because you get a few rewards points. Or rent, things like that. Utilities. You're not going to leave the lights on. Honey, leave the lights on. We're getting rewards points. The idea that cash discounting just is irrelevant for merchants, that they want to be able to discriminate between rewards cards and non-rewards cards and only take the non-rewards cards or pass on the additional price of getting rewards to the person who gets the benefit. That rewards cards holders should have to internalize the cost of their rewards.
Yeah, I'll try to be brief. I think in terms of what people know, what they should know, it's a lot of things we don't know we should know. You know, I don't know what the default rules are on my phone bill, right? How much do I pay in interest if I pay my phone bill late? What are the default terms on my mortgage? If I had a student loan, what would be the default terms? It's not unique to credit cards that we don't pay attention to these things. They're complex. There's a lot of information out there. You know, I can't name three bills that Congress passed last year, and I'm guessing probably nobody but Ollie in this room probably could, right? I mean, why? Because most of the bills, I can't do anything about it, and they're not relevant to me, right? So we conserve on information, so I don't know that that's anything different. Secondly, on interchange, just to flesh out the two-sided market way of thinking about this, I take the Washington Post. I don't read the ads, right? All those advertisers, people who read the ads, are subsidizing my consumption of the Washington Post because, and should they be allowed to make me read the ads, right, because the paper costs less for me? When I watch television, I TiVo through the commercials, right? And so all those who watch the commercials and maybe buy some stuff are subsidizing me, right? The newspaper is an example we call two-sided market. You've got to both have the reader and the advertiser, and the newspaper brings them together. That's basically what credit cards are. It's a two-sided market. You bring the consumer and the retailer together, and you've got to make those two things work so that you've got to both the credit card issuer has to attract both the consumer and the retailer, and this is one of the ways that they do this, and this is one of the ways that they compete for both sides of that market, and this is ubiquitous, and it requires you to understand the pricing and the cross-subsidizations that cut back and forth, just like a newspaper is basically what it is. Final thing is on the retroactive pricing point, which, you know, I don't have any strong feelings one way or another on the equities. I mean, I understand the equities. I mean, I think Ollie put his finger on the problem, which is that prices can go up or down, right? Which is, I could borrow at $5,000 and, 15% interest, and then, go get a 0% interest rate card from somebody else and pay off the $5,000 that they were expecting me to pay 15% interest on, right? It seems silly to say that I should be required to pay back my credit card at the amount I originally borrowed it at, right? I shouldn't be allowed to refinance by getting a new credit card. So that seems kind of silly. So what's the result going to be? The result is going to be that the issuer is going to have to deal with if issuers can only reduce prices but not increase prices, then they're obviously going to set a higher price to begin with, right? And then the question becomes whether or not that's good or bad. The nature of revolving credit is it's a month-to-month loan that I can prepay anytime I want to. I can go get another card and pay off my first card. I could go get a home equity loan and pay off the first card. There's no prepayment penalties for me, even if the credit card issuer expected I was going to revolve. So I think that in the end, it turns out to be a cost-benefit analysis as to what the impact would be in terms of credit card issuers being less willing to give flexible pricing and what the increase in interest rates would likely be as a result of that. And I don't know the answer to that, but I think that's how the inquiry would proceed.
Mr. Dirk. Well, I agree with that. I think that there's always going to be some difficulties in seeing these things even post hoc. In other words, if the if sellers or issuers of credit cards charge higher rates going forward, and they're going to have to get revenue from somewhere. In other words, as Todd points out, that people, it's a, you know, a heads I win as a consumer, I can refinance, but tails that they lose because they can't ever go up with the rate, that's going to cause rates to be higher, other things being equal at the outset. They're going to have to be. I mean, this is not something that people are not going to want to defend themselves against these sorts of risks. I mentioned before the diversification, unsecured credit, and political risk and other things that are present in the credit card market. They're going to have to deal with the potential for not being able to change rates going forward also. But the thing is that we're not going to be able to show this very well in the future because other things are changing at the same time. In other words, I said other things being equal, rates are going to have to be higher, but other things are never equal. The cost of funds is going to be different. The business cycle is going to be different. There are more people may be out of work, and so the credit card portfolio becomes riskier even if they don't add risk on purpose and so forth. And so it's going to be hard to show it. But, you know, it's got to be in fact, the case. It doesn't come out of the air.
Okay. I'm going to try and take one more short question. I'll just – my own personal opinion is that none of the bills will pass. The Senate isn't an absolute cement. They still got the supplemental. They got a couple of approach bills, an omnibus or a CR put together. They got it's a very short schedule. And on top of all that, I had lunch with Bill Timmons last week, and he said nothing's going to pass. If he says nothing's going to pass, nothing's going to pass. So we'll take time for one more question, a short question, short answers.
I had one, but I'll take a second one, John Choate. Okay, on this Adam Levinton's page on summary of credit card legislation, as a convenience to those that aren't familiar with it, like me, what is office? What is double cycle billing? What is the... a few of these terms that may not be obvious to the people who aren't doing this every day.
On-off and office is the easy one to explain. An on-us transaction means a so say you have a credit card from the Bank of Levitin, and maybe you have another. You also have a mortgage from the Bank of Levitin. An on-us transaction would be any transaction, including on your credit card, that related to the same creditor, so a Bank of Levitin transaction. Any on-us behavior would be anything if you're late within any account you have with the Bank of Levitin. Off-us behavior would be if you miss a bill payment to the Bank of Ireland. So does that clarify the distinction there? On-us and off-us means that it's behavior related to the issuer or behavior unrelated to the accounts with the issuer.
I'm late with Ireland, and you find out, and so you raise my rights.
You got it.
Okay.
That's called cross default, or universal default.
That's what the office is. Right. Universal default. Okay.
You ever see a commercial transaction without cross default in it?
No, that's correct. But how many other consumer transactions do you ever see? Do you see auto loans with universal default, or student loans? Only credit cards.
The question is not. I mean, the question is not what's in other transactions, I think. The question is this a prudent, reasonable credit practice? And it is a prudent and reasonable credit practice, and it is a well-established credit practice, and people's behavior in other transactions is predictive of their behavior in your transactions, and I think that's statistically irrefutable.
That's all correct. However, the major catch and what differentiates the commercial market from the consumer market is the quality of information about off-us transactions. Commercial credit reporting is pretty good. Consumer credit reporting is pretty lousy. Only half of mortgage foreclosures ever show up on consumer credit reports. There's an over-reporting problem and an under-reporting problem, and it ends up being just kind of a crapshoot as to what an issuer sees and what the issuer thinks is a trigger. And the problem is you don't know what's going to be that trigger. It's entirely in the issuer's discretion. So let me explain double-cycle billing. Actually, to try and explain in 1 second is going to be hard. We can talk afterwards.
Since you two started, Todd, you get a minute. Mr. Durbin, you get a minute.
Yeah, I'll just be very brief. I don't know whether a cross default is efficient or not, but there are reasons why you might see it in credit card transactions, but not other transactions. Credit cards are very unusual consumer credit product in that they are uniquely prone to what we think of as a moral hazard problem, which is that you make a car loan to somebody and they start paying it off. The deal with a credit card is that I could give you, say, a $5,000 line of credit. When you have a job, then you get fired, and then all of a sudden you go from being a good risk to a bad risk, right? And at the same time, you start borrowing money, right? And so that's a very peculiar kind of transaction, and I would think that the logic of universal default, if there is a logic, would have to be along those sorts of lines, which is that because of these unique problems of moral hazard, there may be different tripwires built into the system. I'm not sure if that's what's going on or not, but I think some of the anomalies or things that look peculiar in credit cards may reflect something weird about credit cards compared to traditional credit products.
Mr. Durkin, you get the last word.
Okay, well, yes. There's a big difference between an automobile loan and a credit card loan. One of them is the credit card, or the automobile loan is a fixed rate transaction, and it has to be priced then for the risk that's based on a fixed rate transaction that's going to go on for 3, 4, or 5 years. A credit card is not priced that way. It's priced on the repricing being possible very rapidly. And so, therefore, to use your example, that no, you can be repriced on a credit card on an old balance. Well, you cannot be repriced on an automobile loan, but if you go to get an automobile the next loan day and you have defaulted with somebody else, you'll be repriced all right. That auto loan the next day is not going to be the same as the previous day before you defaulted. So there's really no difference. It's just that one is an ongoing relationship and one is not.
Okay. Thank you very much for your attendance. Thank you very much, panelists, for an outstanding presentation. Thank you to the Federal Society of Co-Sponsors.